Kaya, Wanju, hello, welcome to another episode of The Curb. I'm Andrew F. Pierce, and this is the podcast where I bring you in-depth interviews with filmmakers, creatives, and curators of culture. This podcast is recorded in Boolu, Western Australia, sovereignty never ceded. Welcome to the third episode of our summer series of chats where I catch up with filmmakers and creatives who are behind some of the year's best films. On this episode, I catch up with Academy Award-winning Master of Stop-Motion Animation, Adam Elliott, and Emmy Award and Actor Award-winning screen legend, Sarah Snook, to talk about their mollusk motion flick, Memoir of a Snail. Memoir of a Snail is driven by the delightfully dark sense of comedy and relatable pathos, both of which bring the off-kilter world of Grace Puddle, or Pudel, as Sarah Snook has often said, and her equally orphaned twin brother Gilbert, played by Cody Smick-McPhee, to life. It's a film that resonated immediately with audiences around the world, with each person able to find a little bit of themselves in this tender tale of Grace and her obsession with snails. As always, Elliott is able to bring forth a welcome sense of groundedness to his plasticine characters. And while they may physically appear eccentric, there's something about each and every one of them that makes us feel seen. As with his previous film, Mary and Max, Elliott actively removes stigmas associated with those who live with mental illnesses, while also shining a light on those who try to vilify, condemn, or, in the case of Gilbert, cruelly convert them away from their true self. The authenticity that sits at the core of Memoir of a Snail is not just driven by the characters we see on screen, but also from the empathetic and grounded voice work from Sarah Snook, Cody Smick-McPhee, and other screen icons like Jackie Weaver, Magda Zubanski, Tony Armstrong, Eric Bana, while French icon Dominique Pignon also makes an appearance. In the following conversations with Adam, then following with Sarah, I talk about how they both built that relatability on screen, and what it means to show Australian stories in this way. And then curiously, we also talk about the importance of dress-up boxes in the homes of Australian kids. There really is something for everyone here in this conversation. But, as both Adam and Sarah stress, this is not a film for kids, it is a film for adults, and that's the important aspect of this animated film. That I want to thank the publicists Maria Clement and Antonio Gimenez Palazon for their support in organising these interviews. It means a lot. If you want to find out more about the work that we do and to listen to previous entries in the summer series of chats, then please head over to thecurb.com.au. We're also a completely independent and ad-free website. It lives on the support of listeners and readers just like yourself. If you can and you want to support us, please visit patreon.com/thecurbau to help keep our lights on from as little as $1 a month. Memoir of a Snail is now available to view on demand in Australia. And while it's definitely not for kids, it is one Aussie film you really should see before the year is out. Now, here's a trailer for Memoir of a Snail, followed by my interview with Adam Elliott, and then my interview with Sarah Snook.
I wasn't always this alone. My childhood was full of people. The nurse said we had two souls but one heart. Hey, morons! Look, Gracie, they're hugging. In glasses half full and silver linings. Then my glass was shattered. Bye, Gracie.
Bye, Gilbert.
We had no choice but to move onwards. Pinky was the only colour in my life.
Yeah. How are you feeling? Like, because I know you've kind of jet set around the world and seen everything and talked to a million different people, but how are you feeling sitting with this film and seeing the reactions from everybody?
Well, the word I use a lot is relief. I think because it took so long to get this film made, we had COVID, we had all sorts of, trying to raise the money is always tricky. And, you know, when you finish a film, you're depleted and you're a bit over it. And but then you start showing it to audiences, and you're reminded of the, you know, particularly with theatrical screenings, when you're sitting in with the audience, listening to them laugh, but also the lights come up and you can see that they've cried as well. It all makes it worth the effort and the pain. And the audience will never appreciate the blood, sweat and tears that go into making any film, let alone a stop motion one. So I think relief. I'm just glad that it all wasn't a waste of time for myself and my artists, and also the Australian taxpayer who paid for all this. So yeah, I can finally sleep.
Well, good. I mean, you've still got a lot of coverage to go, because obviously we're deep in the award season and everything. It's very exciting, again, to have that kind of conversation. We won't go into that all too much, because I want to talk about the film, but I want to go back to kind of the beginning of it. And I know the foundational story, but I'm curious about what your work looks like when you first have the script going. Do you write the script and then do a storyboard and then do the stop motion? How does your process work?
Yeah, look, I do. I'm very linear and chronological. Other animators, directors do it differently. But yeah, I very much focus on the screenplay only at that point. I don't draw any of the characters yet or play with the clay. It's script, script, script. And this one took 3 years roughly and 16 drafts. I did a lot of research into hoarding. Also, the film's based on a friend of mine who was born with a cleft palate, so I did a lot of research into that. So they're very slow to manifest. And of course, writing's a very, as you would know, very lonely at times, very challenging. You spend a lot of time staring out the window. And then, of course, you know, once the script's locked off and the investors are happy, it's then the fun part begins, and that's the character design. But what I do next is the storyboard. So I sit down and I hand drew 1,500 little storyboard panels, and then I moved on to the character design, and I drew every character, every set, every prop. And then finally we got a studio, we rented a big space, and we started to employ the dozens and dozens of animators and camera people and sculptors and painters. And that was a real fun bit, was the actual making of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm curious then, throughout all of this process, like this takes place over years, of course. How do you keep the emotional consistency or fidelity to the story, and you know that what you've written and what you're creating still has an emotional truth to it?
Well, actually, it's one of the things I do is actually get the crew to all read the script. You know, and a lot of films, the crew don't necessarily have to read the script, but I make it mandatory. And that's really because I need them to be enthusiastic, because by that stage, I'm already exhausted. I'm already sick of the characters. I'm already sick of snails. And I need to then feed off the crew's enthusiasm and also knowledge of the story. And so I have a very good animation supervisor, John Lewis, who really is a solutionist, I call him. He's a problem solver. And in many ways, at that point, when you're making the film, I've given the film over to them. And my job is then just to approve things and yes, no, maybe, yes, no, maybe. And really that's what you're doing as a director all day, is just making the final decision on things. Also use the analogy of, you know, steering this big ship or being the ringmaster of a circus. You know, there's all the conductor of an orchestra. Because by that stage too, it's very collaborative, and it's no longer me in isolation. It's a shared experience.
Yeah, I find that so fascinating. Obviously, it's every film is a communal effort, but there is something specific about stop motion, because the decisions that you're making, you know, it is creating an emotion down the line, and so you've got to be all in harmony. So with that in mind, how is the set? What's the mood on the set? Do you have music playing? Do you have things going on the set to create that kind of harmony?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's very strange, because there's a duality there, because the sets can be very chaotic, especially when you're bumping in all the bits and pieces, the camera gear. It's just like a live action film. It's a lot of people, a lot of moving parts, a lot of coordination. But then when the animator goes in to animate, suddenly it's all quiet, peaceful, dark. The animator puts their headphones on, listens to music, and that's when the slow motion begins, and it's very meditative and relaxing. It can be tedious, of course, but that's when the magic happens. And that's why I call my animators the actors, and people like Sarah Snooker, the voice talent. And so, yeah, it's a very, this duality. It's this chaos, but then at these moments of pure silence and quietness. So, yeah. Mm.
So with the voice talent, do you have them in mind early on, or is that kind of the casting of them a late development during the process?
It's a bit of both. I mean, unfortunately, in animation, we do, if there's lip sync, we have to get the characters recorded up front. And that's always a challenge, to get the actors signed up and on board early. But we're very lucky with Sarah. She came on board pretty early, and Cody and Jackie. But then people like Nick Cave were able to get him recorded last, because it was all post-sync and voiceover, so it didn't matter as much. So, yeah, the actors are sort of come in and be recorded always in isolation, but sprinkled throughout the shoot. And some of them don't come in until we're actually editing. But yeah, it's great. It's great actually that you get to deal with the actors in isolation. You never have to worry about dealing with multiple egos at the same time. You always just have one at a time, and you really get to focus. And working with Sarah was wonderful. She just, there was no ego. She knew exactly what I was after. We even brought in one of the Sylvia the Snails and put that down on the table next to her in the sound recording booth, so she could just talk to Sylvia and get that authenticity and that real intimacy that I was after.
Yeah. I'm curious as well, because you know a lot of the actors that are in the film, they do have distinct voices themselves, but in the film, it's not like we can sit there and go, well, that's Sarah Snook, right? Because she's doing such a great job. So can you talk about the getting them to build a character that was like distinct, different from who they are as people?
Yeah, well, firstly, you know, I never put the actors' names at the beginning of the film. I don't want to give away who's who. And the worst thing you could ever have is the audience imagining the actor in a sound booth being recorded. It just, you know, obviously ruins the whole illusion, because it's all, you know, obviously in animation, it's all smoke and mirrors, it's all trickery. And we have to convince the audience very early on that this voice is coming from this clay blob. And that suspension of disbelief has to be absolute. The audience have to give over very quickly and believe for the next hour and a half that this is all real. So yeah, it's tricky. And that's why I don't get the actors to ever put on voices. I always try and just get their natural speaking voice, which is why I chose Sarah as well, because her Australian accent wasn't too thick. It was easy to understand what she was saying. You know, obviously some Australian films end up having to have subtitles, like certain Irish films or Scottish films. It was very important that her voice was very universal and understandable. But also too, people like Cody's a very, you know, he's a young actor, but he's sort of very philosophical, he's quite dark and brooding, and see, he had all these elements that I really liked. And then Jackie, of course, you know, she's a great comedian, but she can also do poignancy very well. She's age appropriate. Jackie's almost 80 now, and so she brought a real authenticity to the character. So yeah, it's tricky. It's always difficult. Sometimes you get a great actor and some great animation, but you put the two together and they don't marry. And that's always a fear, that they're just not going to marry, because usually by then it's too late. You've already paid all this money. But I was very lucky that we got a great cast. I got everyone I wanted. We didn't have to compromise at all. And I think, you know, the actors themselves really were enthusiastic. It wasn't about money. It was actually just trying to give a performance that was very visceral and believable.
Well, I imagine for a lot of people, like working with somebody who's done Harvey Crumpet and Mary and Max, right? You're aware of the prestige of those films, because obviously you're, you know, the mind behind them. But there's an allure to working with somebody like you, and there's a comfort in working with somebody like you because you trust them to do it. What does that feel like for you as a director, knowing that there is that trust?
Oh, yeah. Well, look, it's gotten easier over the years to get these big names because of the precedent I have. You know, I think working with people like Philip Seymour Hoffman and Toni Collette and Jeffrey Rush has certainly made my life easier now. But I still, you know, I think when the actor does finally come into the sound booth and they're, you know, it all becomes very professional, and they realise that I'm the director and I realise that they're the actor and that we're there to do a job and get the very best performance we can. And it's always terrifying. It's every time I go in to record an actor, I'm way more nervous than I am directing an animator or someone else on the film. I think it's because you're paying a lot of money and you've got a small amount of time to get the gold you're after, because the actors are very in demand. They're busy. Often they're on the other side of the world. Like Nick Cave, we had to record him in London. I was here. So you've got a gun at your head the whole time. Whereas when you're animating, you've got 33 weeks to solve the problems and get the performances you want. So it's less pressurized. I think it's the pressure of directing voice talent that you know, keeps me awake at night.
All right, let's talk about the themes of the film, because there's an aspect of isolation, and particularly I loved your choice of locations for the story, you know, ACT, Western Australia. Can you talk about that? Like, look, a bit of background about myself. I'm a absolute Canberra faithful. For my 40th birthday, I wanted to go to Parliament House, so that's how obsessed I am with Canberra. As I said, I'm from Western Australia, so getting to watch this film was like this marriage of both of those things. But I'm curious for you what the draw is to tell those stories in those locations.
Well, firstly, you know, most of my relatives live in Canberra, so it was just making fun of them. And they all came to the screening when we were in Canberra. And the funny thing was, they all enjoyed the film. They all forgave me. And then they said, well, let's all go out for a drink afterwards. And, of course, nothing was open. So we came back to the hotel and had a glass of water in the foyer. You know, so I've always loved Canberra. I love visiting there. I go to Canberra a lot, actually. I go to Canberra more than Sydney. And then Perth, I've got a lot of friends there. A lot of my crew are from Perth. My producer, Liz Carney's from Perth. So, and actually, weirdly, you know, there's a lot of cults in Perth, apparently, out in the suburbs. There's all sorts of interesting cults. But also, too, geographically, it just made sense that Gilbert be as far away from Grace as possible. So that's why I chose Canberra and Perth, because they are so far away from each other. It wouldn't have really worked if she was in Adelaide or Perth. So geographically, that was another reason. Also, too, I feel like in all my other films, I've celebrated Melbourne. And I think, you know, I wanted to move on to... Plus, also, no one ever puts Canberra in a film. Poor old Canberra. You never get... It's always Sydney or Melbourne. And, you know, my next film, actually, I've started writing. It's going to be a road film where the character goes all around Australia. So I finally get to, you know, use Adelaide and Northern Territory and, you know, Queensland.
Oh, it's exciting. But, yeah, I mean, there's something cinematic about Canberra, and getting to see it through your perspective was quite delightful as well. I'm curious, then, if we're talking about Australia, like, what does it mean to be able to tell Australian stories in a stop-motion format? Like, it's so unique and brings a certain style to it, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, all my films, and for the last 28 years, it's been this duality of trying to create stories that are very universal and understandable in countries like Sweden and Iran and Argentina, but also have an Australian flavour there and an Australian sensibility and Australian iconography without it becoming too many kangaroos bouncing down the street. And so I've always chosen parts of Australia that I find sentimental. So like a Chico roll, for example, rather than a meat pie, and the Melbourne Arts Centre rather than, I don't know, Uluru or something. You know, so I pick things that have been explored less often, but also try and infuse that Australian sense of humour, the self-deprecation, irony, sarcasm, absurdity, all those things that Australians are known for. But again, making sure the characters are relatable and identifiable. And I think that's what's happened with Grace, particularly for a lot of younger people, not little kids, of course, but teenagers, young adults are really identifying with Grace. Because I know from the sheer amount of messages I'm getting every day, they're all from young people, whereas Mary and Max, it was much a much older demographic. So that's been really interesting to see who, you know. I mean, it seems to be this film is probably the broadest in terms of the demographic it's appealing to. I mean, I still get alarmed when people are bringing their 8-year-old children to the film. It's you know, it's rated R, rated M. They should not be bringing their kids. But I think that's just because people still believe it's a genre. As you know, it's not. It's a medium. And I'm always going to face that challenge of you know, people. It'd probably be the most common criticism I get. Adam, your films are not for children. Well, of course they're not. Why do you know? So it's fighting that mindset constantly. But the good thing is it's changing. I really feel that audiences are starting to understand, particularly in America, that animation's not a genre.
I mean, you've got films like Anomalisa, which has really pushed that. And I remember going to see that in the cinema, and there was a family with three kids, and they lasted about 20 minutes of that film. So, you know, it's the literacy, I guess, that people need to have, audience literacy. And to me, I hear what you're saying about having an 8-year-old go and see it, but I watched Texas Chainsaw Massacre when I was 13 years old, right? And I'm not saying your film's on that level, but that stuck with me in a way that few films did. And I shouldn't have been watching at that age, but watching Memoir of a Snail at 8 years old might stick with them and guide their perspective on the world.
That's the thing, is that weirdly my films are now taught in high schools all around the world as educational devices to teach about difference and acceptance. And I know the kids who have snuck into cinemas to watch my films really do respond, and actually particularly French kids are, you know, I think a little bit more sophisticated than Australian kids or American kids. And so, you know, I certainly don't recommend people take young kids. It's really up to the parents to gauge whether they think their child will be able to handle things. It's probably more so that the kids don't understand a lot of the stuff. It's not that they'll be terrified or traumatized. I think it's just a lot of the adult messaging is going to go over their heads, you know. I mean, the gay conversion scene might be scary, but I don't think they would understand what's really going on. And it's funny, you put on a poster for the film, adults only, and of course, reverse psychology happens. The kids will go and see it purely because they've been told they're not allowed to.
But, right, so you've got people messaging you, letting you know what the emotional response is. There is a safety to being able to see, and I use this word lightly, there's a safety to being able to see some kind of weird on screen that you can relate to. And that's got to mean a lot. Like, for me, watching Mary and Max was that experience of going, oh, these two characters are something that I haven't seen on screen before and I can relate to. That's got to be comforting for you to be able to know that that's reaching that way.
Yes, and that the film's having a positive impact. And I know from the sheer volume of messages I'm getting that, you know, they all say things like, oh, my favourite film of the year, or it's the first film where I felt validated. I've had messages from twins. I've had messages from people with cleft palates that say, you know, it's the first time I've seen a film. You know, so, yeah, they're all very, very positive. I mean, and you think that's, you know, that's why I make films, is actually to know that you're having some impact. You know, I'm not saving people's lives, but I'm certainly, you know, the films can be nourishing and linger with people, which is what I'm really relieved about, is the film seems to be lingering with people. But also, too, you know, there are people who find the film too dark, or they find it, you know, I burned down a church, so there's fundamentals who out there find that offensive, that I burned the crucifix. But they're missing the point. It's not about that. It's about, you know, the cruelty of gay conversion therapy. And I'm really, it's a comment on organized religion. I mean, it's not a comment on religion itself. It's a comment on more on cults and religions that exploit their congregations. So, you know, you're never going to please everybody. But I think this film it's early days, but I feel like it's really reaching and connecting far more people with far more people than Mary Max or Harvey Crumpet, and in a positive way, which is again a big relief.
Yeah, the experience of talking with people who have seen it and stuff. And as you mentioned, like WA does surprisingly have a large number of cults. Gay conversion therapy is something that we're still working through. And so, you know, there are people I've talked to who've gone and seen this and they're like, oh, surely this is from the 1950s. Like that's something, it's a relic of the past. And it's like, no, actually, it's still around. Yeah. And so it opens up a door for that kind of conversation. I've really appreciated being able to talk with you about your work and getting to experience it over the years. It's been a real delight, Adam. Thank you so much for the time and for your films as well. Like, again, as we talked about, they mean so much to people. And I'm glad that you're aware of that because, you know, that's why films exist, right? It's why we watch them. So we feel
something. You know, and Andrew, really, it gives me I always say it gives me the confidence to keep making them because, you know, they're so difficult to get up and running. And there are plenty of times where I've wanted to throw in the towel. But, you know, I think it's when the film's released that you realise, you know, as a filmmaker, how far-reaching your stories can go and be. And you know, that's what gives me the enthusiasm to start another one. It's like having a baby. You think, that's it, I'm never doing that again. I'm never getting pregnant. But 6 months later,
Well, I've talked to a few stop motion animators in Australia who have specifically said, because Adam's done it, I've been able to do it. And that's huge, right? Wow. And so it's wonderful to be able to see. So thank you for your work. Thank you for encouraging others and everything else. You're a huge inspiration. So thank you, Adam. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks, Andrew. Thanks for your support. Okay.
Losing a twin is like losing an eye. You never see the world the same way again. Life isn't about looking backwards, Gracie. It's about living forwards. The worst cages are the ones we create for ourselves. It's time for you to shed your shell. Set yourself free.
Thank you so much for your time and being able to talk about bunch of other things alongside Memoir of a Snail, but specifically talking about Memoir of a Snail to start off with. It's been a bit of a whirlwind of a year for the film, I imagine, and I'm curious what it's like for you to have seen the reception that everybody has to, you know, Grace and, you know, what Adam and yourself have created.
Yeah, it's been amazing. I think it's such credit to Adam's perceptiveness and creativity that, you know, and also like the quality to be able to persist with something for so long. Like, you know, it's like an 11-year filmmaking journey, and the process of moving a frame by frame by frame, it's over 150,000 odd frames to make up the movie that have all been done by hand. It's like 150,000 artworks. Put together and press play, to know what the balance is of light and shade, of humour and sadness, and to then persist with that and see the benefits of that coming back where audiences go like, yep, you got it. Well done, Adam. Like, you really nailed it. Oh, thank God. You know, like, what an achievement, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the first time that I saw it, it was in Perth, and, you know, just hearing the audience walk out and they're like, oh, Grace is me, you know, I relate so much to her. That's got to mean so much to you as an actor, right?
Totally. You know, I think Grace, I feel like there's a lot of me in Grace. There's something, you know, the gentle kind of shy or sensitive side, and the person who is fearful of taking risks. You know, I think it's been really nice to kind of get to know that part of myself, or allow that part of myself to be seen on camera through a claymation snail lady.
Yeah. So it's like you're having tracked your work. I talked to, gosh, I'm terrible with names, but the carbon film, you've voiced inanimate objects before, is what I'm trying to say. And like listening to you in that is a whole, giving emotion to this inanimate object, which is carbon, right? And then you've done also a plant too. So you've returned to voice acting in different ways, but I don't think I've experienced such emotionality as I did with Grace. I'm curious if you can talk about what draws you to the art of voice work too.
Yeah, I love it. I grew up reading books to myself when I was a kid. My mum would often hear me doing Roald Dahl's Revolting Rhymes off by heart to myself, but then also whenever I would read one of his books, like The Witches, she's got memories of me reading all sorts of like character voices of the Grand High Witch to myself, remove your wings. That as like a 7-year-old reading to herself in bed. So I think I've always enjoyed the play that comes with voice and that you can find as becoming a different character, maybe, the fast switch of that between the narrator, the character, and the other character in dialogue. So getting an opportunity to explore that, like doing Koala Man as well, like 2 years ago, a year or so ago, that finding a different kind of like, what is the tone there, that what's the pitch there that this character has, and how can we shape a character through audio or oral only, and then collaborate on the visual with the filmmakers.
And then, of course, like recently you made history as being one of the first voice actors to be nominated for an acting award at the Actors. And I'm curious what that means to you to like forge some kind of path of history there.
Yeah, I didn't know that was I didn't know actually that was history making, but also I guess I didn't know that it was possible. I didn't know until my mum texted me and said, "Congratulations." I was like, "What are you talking about? What for?" For the nomination. And in my head, I'm running through going, there's nothing that's possibly nominatable for me to be nominated for. I don't, you've lost your marbles, mum. I don't know what you're talking about. So to be nominated for voice is really very special and very, what an honor. And I think, I feel like that's an enormous amount to do with Adam and the team's animation and the music and everything. It's a collaboration in that sense, for sure.
Yeah, but then, like, I talked to Adam, and I know that you did a lot of your voice work with the snail sitting there, so like you were talking directly to the snail. So it's not, the humility is appreciated, but like, there it's not just that. Like, you are having a relationship with an inanimate object and talking with it. And what was that experience like?
Was great. I mean, I had also just had my daughter, and so she often came into the sessions. She was on the other side of the glass, so we couldn't hear her. And I think there's a closeness to vulnerability and openness and sensitivity that comes with those immediate months of postpartum. So maybe there's something in there that helped add a different tenderness to the voice.
Yeah. At what point did you come on to the project too?
Beginning of 2023, it kind of went round in loops. It was it came at me from all sorts of different places. Ash Zuckerman, who's a friend of mine who we worked together on Succession and is a brilliant Australian actor, he told me about it through his, I want to say, stepdad or uncle. I can't remember how he was related to it, but he was like, someone's trying to get a script in front of you, and I'm just letting you know that this is happening. You need to chase this up. And yeah, I'm really glad that I did. Even my mother-in-law knows the editor, and so she told me about it, and it's really like Adam was relentless, and I really appreciate it.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Like, there is what I really appreciate about your work, not just the voice work, but also the acting too, is that you have this dedication to Australiana, and there is this real sense of the Australian accent coming through in the work here. And there is something so purely Australian about Grace and the characters in Memoir of a Snail. And I love that because we so rarely get to hear the Australian voice on a huge stage. Is that something you think about at all?
Totally. And it's something for me as well, and just being in my own natural accent is so pleasurable, like having to filter thoughts through an American or British or anything. It's just that's me. And there's a real joy in being able to express that. And I think, agents probably were protecting me in a way of going, oh, she's just had a baby. She can't possibly do any work right now. She's been explicit about wanting to have time off. But something like this is so, it's just so, gentle. There's a real, like, warm hug about the film. She goes through so much, and so much of it is depressing. But there is something, there is always that spark and ray of hope that the fact that she just keeps on keeping on is, there is real strength in that.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is it's almost like this recontextualization of what the Aussie battler actually is. Yeah. Right. And and that's it leans into what I really love about it too, is, you know, I live in Perth. I am a huge fan of Canberra. So getting to see both of those kinds of really minute aspects of Australia presented on screen is so wonderful. Does that kind of play into your choice as well? Like getting to see a real small slice of what Australia can be?
Totally. And that real, you know, dedicated Australiana, where I didn't think it would translate to overseas audiences, and I was really surprised and heartened by the French audiences in the Annecy Film Festival giving it the top prize, because, like, did they get the Melbourne jokes? And Adam was like, I don't think it's about that. And it's like, well, of course not, but you're right. Yeah, you're right. There's something that where you recognise, you know, it would be recognised sort of small town mindedness or small mindedness or small kind of jokes in jokes, and they're funny because you can relate them to your own in-jokes that you have about your village or your town or your city that you love.
Mm. Yeah. I want to kind of take a step back as well for, you know, obviously talking about Memoir of a Snow, which is huge, but 10 years ago, Predestination comes out, which is kind of first thing that really puts you on the map. And, you know, I'd seen you in a whole bunch of other stuff, specifically These Final Hours, which is really good too, representing WA there. But have you had time to reflect on the impact that Predestination had? Because it really put you on the map in a way that, you know, it was just really unexpected, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I haven't really, but I guess part of my experience of Predestination, which was definitely appreciated, was it came out at the same time as the Sony hack happened. And it was part of Sony, and it kind of came out in this way. And also Ethan Hawke was doing Boyhood at the time, so the press for Boyhood took precedence. And it came out in this moment where it was like, Predestination! And a few people managed to see it, and a few people grabbed onto it, but it didn't do the sort of the big splash that it maybe could have or should have, or who knows. But what was really special about that, though, was that then throughout the last 10 years, I've had people go, oh my God, have you seen this film? And we're like, oh wow, have you seen, did you know about this? Why doesn't more people see this? Why haven't, and that's something really special about that, that word of mouth that is like the strength of that film has carried it on through different viewing platforms and different ways of accessing it. And I've really enjoyed the journey that seeing that from afar, I guess.
I mean, I remember watching it. Like, I watched it on the first time, which is a terrible place to watch. I watched it on a plane and just being like, feeling, you know, I got to get off this plane and tell people about this movie, you know?
Yeah.
It was this experience. About, like,
and the abnormality of being on a, like, 30,000 feet in the sky and feeling like you're in a sort of time travel tuna can thing anyway. That's great. Seeing it on a plane would be really unusual, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I've been able to see it in the cinema since, but that specific feeling was just like, oh my gosh, this is so unexpected. And, you know, getting to watch your career go on and having all these versatility is what an actor should be doing, of course, but specifically the characters that you presented across your career, like Predestination and The Dressmaker and then now Memoir of a Snail, there is so many different aspects of Australiana, which is what I guess I'm so in awe of, that, like, after doing Succession and, like, you know, Steve Jobs and stuff like that, you'd almost expect that somebody like yourself to really stick with just doing an American or British career.
But yeah.
You keep on returning to Australia.
Well, yeah, I hope to be able to find balance.
What's the drive?
In both of them. Yeah. I hope to be able to find balance in both of that, both of those sides. I think, you know, I've always wanted to be able to continue calling Australia home. I've lived overseas and worked overseas with the jobs that have taken me there, but I've always come back to Australia. And part of that, I think, is, like, it's my home, my family, my friends are all here. And the world is so so easily international now. We are so easily connected that I haven't felt the pull to go, like, to abandon one side or the other. You know, things can be multiplicitous. You know, you can be in different spaces all at once, thanks to the internet. and that sort of fits an actor and my desires anyway, you know, wanting to be different characters, different places.
And that, like, the relatability of Australiana has kind of been a little bit more accepted because now people have a real clear understanding of what the Australian personality is, what the Australian voice can do. Has that been your perspective at all from an actor's point of view?
Yeah, I think I probably grew up in a time where Australiana had its moment in the 80s and Foster's and America's Cup and Crocodile Dundee, and then it went through this dip of, like, real cringe. You don't, you know, the American cultural homogeneity, you're sort of, like, looking towards America for the guy, you know, Chicago Bulls, and we're all, like, looking at American culture to emulate. And I think of late, it seems, there's a real ownership these days now of Australiana and it's the Australian character and personality and the broader spectrum of that. It's not just the you know, the Bunnings tradie. It's like it's everybody, and I think that's a real, it's like a country character coming out, which is nice.
Yeah, and I mean I get that sense of it being, you know, taking place as well behind the scenes when you're shooting something. I watched Kieran and the discussion on Variety that Kieran Culkin did recently, and he mentioned like the one person that he loves working with is you, and he would love to work with you again. But it's also that part of the reason that I could sense from it was because of your Australiana and the way that you deal with being Australian on a set. And we, like, Australians bring a certain energy to work, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at. And it changes the tone of things. Yeah. I don't know if you want to add to that at all. Yeah.
I think so. I think, you know, I've always enjoyed working on Australian sets. There's a muck in and get it done kind of attitude, and a don't take yourself too seriously attitude. And, you know, on the bad side of that, that's like, there's tall poppy and it's don't take yourself too seriously, and that can go too far one way. But then the other side of that is, like, there's a real freedom and joy of being able to laugh at yourself and just remember you're being paid to dress up for a living, you know? Like, we're all working in the dress-up box, which is great. And I think bringing that kind of attention to detail and professionalism, but lack of seriousness in certain areas is really useful on a set.
Yeah, it's so interesting you mentioned, like, the dress-up box, you know. We all kind of grew up with that as kids, and I fear that's kind of disappeared a little bit. Like, certainly my...
Oh, no.
Yeah, my sister doesn't have a dress-up box for her kids, and I'm like, where is it? You know, you've got to have the dress-up box. And, you've got a kid now. Is that something you're going to make sure?
My daughter has definitely got a dress-up
box. Good, good.
And we're, you know, she's the daughter of two actors. We're not forcing it on her. She seems to be gravitating towards it herself. She's very into wearing hats and doesn't mind the odd wig. I don't know where she's found these wigs in the first place, but I think she thinks they're hats, but, like, just hairy ones. She loves putting on a costume, I think toddlers do that. They put on pairs of shoes and they put on a shirt and they're like, oh, I'm like mummy or daddy, or there's imaginative play. And I remember having the dress-up box at my kindergarten, and that was the first place I would go to straight away as soon as I got there. So it's definitely something that will go strong in our house.
Yeah, I mean, it's the freedom of creativity, right? And the space to be creative and see what being somebody else feels like. And I guess nowadays it feels like that's almost stifled a little bit, but it's comforting to hear that, you know, no, it's still there. Have you noticed, like...
Definitely. I think it's... I don't know if it's, I mean, I don't know, my friends, I don't know if they have dress-up boxes, but I do know that there's probably a lot of, like, superhero kind of dress-up, kind of, like, you've got a whole outfit that's Spider-Man or it's a Transformer or it's, you know, I think I appreciated the free-form play of not really knowing where this particular dressing gown came from that was green with kind of Chinese brocade, beautiful design on it, but always felt like a king wearing it, or, you know, perhaps was the Sultan, or, you know, you're creating a character out of something rather than necessarily it being a designed character that's being sold to you. But I think, you know, I don't know about the how many dress-up boxes exist in Australian households these days, but I hope they do. I think it's good to be able to, yeah, as you say, play imaginatively, and surely that builds empathy and perspective about being a different person, or how a different person might think, or what they might experience, and levels of status and, you know, haves and haves not. When you're a kid, you're sort of, you're working at being like the king and the servant, or, you know, like, and what does that feel like? You know, maybe it's not so great to be the servant. Maybe it's not so great to be the king. Let's play. Let's work it out. A dress-up box is a great thing.
Yeah, it is. As we lead into wrapping up, it's been wonderful. I did not expect to be talking about dress-up boxes with you, but it is huge. Like, it's hearing you talk about it, yeah, is a huge impact on lives growing up. Yeah. Grace.
I suppose you could say that Adam. I suppose you could say that Adam Elliott's just been playing with his dolls. Yeah. You know, he's been like, it's just, he's like his claymation. His little action figurines.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, taking Grace forward as a character, like, she's going to be part of you going forward. I imagine you're going to have, in 10 years' time, people going, what's your thoughts on Memorifus now? What does that mean to you to have created something so important? I guess in a very succinct way, as we've got like 1 minute left, but.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it will reveal itself in time, which is perhaps very fitting for Memorifus now, because the journey of Grace goes through so many different depressing twists and turns, and then there's a really beautiful revelation at the end that I knew what happened. I saw the film in production. I voiced the character and I still cried. I was like, oh God, man, you really got me, Adam. You really got me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even just thinking about it, I cry. Like, it's the emotionality and the truth of it. So you've created something really beautiful and genuine, and we need more of that. So thank you very much for your work. I've already thanked Adam about
thank
it.
Thank you. My pleasure. Yeah.
And thank you for continuing to do
Australian
work as well. Like, it's huge that you continue to return and create stuff here. I know you're shooting something at the moment, so it means a lot as a supporter of Australian cinema that you do that. So thank you so much.
No, my pleasure. Yeah. Absolute pleasure.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks, Sarah. Have a lovely day. Enjoy.
No worries. Cheers. Thank you. Thanks, Andrew. Bye. See you later.
That is Academy Award winner Adam Elliott and Emmy and Actor Award winner Sarah Snook talking about their latest film, Memorifus Now, which is available on demand right now. Please stick around and continue listening to our summer series of chats on The Curb. Right, we will see you all on the next one.